The Alex Goldstein Property Show.
Stray FM.
Welcome again to the Alex Goldstein Property Show, the only fast-paced property radio show on Stray FM, which aims to give you up-to-the-minute property expert advice from a wide range of related businesses, insider knowledge and know-how all jam-packed in, so you can make the best informed decision when it comes to buying or selling your home. We're available for podcast download on the first of every month, so make sure you sign up to the Alex Goldstein social media accounts to get an early reminder of this and to get great property advice whenever you need it. In this month's show, we will be getting the inside track from Nick Silcock, a specialist architect in Harrogate, on the pitfalls to avoid in this sector. We also discuss how best to present your home with property photographer Ben Thornton. We, of course, also have the Alex Goldstein top tips. So much to cram in, so let's get straight on with it.
Property news with Alex Goldstein.
Stray FM.
This month, we are discussing the outcome of Brexit and to put the record straight. Now, come on, let's face it. When we heard the UK was leaving the EU, what happened? Panic set in. Whilst one half of the UK were revelling in their success, the other half were going into meltdown. The stock exchange was all over the place, sterling fell off a cliff, political resignations went around like wildfire, and let's face it, the doommongers had a field day. People then started buying into this psychological panic about the economy, and they actually lost sight of what was going on. What we've got to remember is that leaving the EU is not an on-off switch type scenario. From the point the UK government invokes Article 50, there are 2 years from that point of detailed renegotiation. So, in other words, it's going to be 2019 before we know the full extent of the detail. The key to all of this is whether you are Brexit or Remain is mindset. By staying positive and keeping calm, you'll start to see the new economic and property landscape in a brand new light. Now, mortgage lending rates, they're at an all-time low and money's never been cheaper to borrow. So therefore, if you're thinking of moving home, you can now go up a couple of rungs on the ladder. The Bank of England have held the interest rate at 0.5%. However, there's talk that that's going to possibly come down. Again, good news if you're borrowing. Supply and demand are kings when it comes to property. In Yorkshire, supply has always been weak, but demand very high, and this has led to prices holding firm in comparison to other parts of the country. So therefore, if you're a homeowner looking to sell, demand remains good, and as long as your guide price is realistic, again, there are answers out there for you as well. Investing and buying in property has rarely been about short-term flipping. So therefore, any changes in the house price index is likely to balance out over the length of ownership. That is why property is always historically proven to be the best investment over the medium to long term. International investors have also played on the currency exchange rates and are increasingly keen to buy. So, the actual conclusion of Brexit is way down the line, and everything in the media currently is, on the most part, educated speculation. So, after all, no country has ever been in this position before. What we do know is that the UK and the EU want a clean break on the best terms for both sides. We need them, and vice versa. So when you look at the world in a positive frame of mind, keep calm and always take a medium viewpoint, the outlook is not so bad after all. Yes, of course, there is some current short-term turbulence, but that's not a surprise. We knew this was going to be the case anyway. Here's a parting thought for you. Will we actually leave the EU in the end? Either way, all the white noise about staying in, going out, meeting in the middle, it's all talk. Am I going to put my life on hold for a minimum of the next 2 years? No, of course I'm not, and I suggest you may wish to do the same. It's great to have Nick Silcock here from Townscape Architects in Harrogate. Nick, thanks very much indeed for sparing the time to come in.
No problem, Alex. Delighted to meet you.
Thanks very much. Just talk us through, because, again, there's a lot of confusion out there. You hear all these sort of job titles and job terms. Just sort of steer everyone in the right direction here. I always hear sort of there's the architects, there's the technologists, and there's the planning consultant. What do these people do? How do they all sort of fit together on the architectural side of things and what you do?
Okay, so there is vast differences between the architect, the architectural technologist, and the planning consultant.
Yeah.
Generally, your architect will have studied at university for 7 years and will be very design focused. He will study a Bachelor of Arts qualification. He will be there to open up your vision for a property, for a piece of land, for a development that you have in mind, and he will be able to pick up an idea and run with it to deliver that vision.
So he's almost the artist, if you like.
He's the artist. He's the creative guy. He will also probably have the skill set to take that vision through the planning process, through the technical design process, and be able to provide all the services that you need to deliver a construction project from that initial conception through to the last nut and bolt and sweeping up on site.
And that's you.
That's me. That's what an architect can do.
So then on the technologist side, who are they?
So an architectural technologist, generally they will study for around 4 years.
Yeah.
They study a Bachelor of Science qualification, so they are far more technical in their skill set. So a successful architectural practice is likely to employ a technologist to be able to deliver the technical aspects, the technical drawings, and provide the firepower behind the scenes to actually do the drawings. So very much less, or generally less, design orientated, but there, and they have a very strong skill set then in the technical understanding of how buildings go together.
Yeah, so it's to do with the more sort of the engineering, the build of it, and how it's actually all going to
all
be come together, the jigsaw part of it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And then the other bit, as we said, was that it was the planning consultant. What do they actually do at the end?
Okay, so planning consultants, they're often used, and we would work with a planning consultant on those sites where they are harder to achieve planning permission. Either the local residents are adverse to some kind of development on a site, and so there's lots of objections, or alternatively, the site goes against planning policy, as in the local council, the local planning department will have a policy that says how a piece of land should be used. If you then go against that policy, then a planning consultant can be used to interpret the policy and to put together a case to demonstrate that actually the proposal that is being put forward is fit for that site. So an architect can often work with a planning consultant side by side. The architect would have the vision, the creativity, and will do the drawings and designs, whereas the planning consultant is very much more policy driven. They are experts in the legal side of it, absolutely. So we work with a consultant to deliver on those more harder to achieve sites.
No, indeed. No, some great explanations there. Thanks very much. And fine, there are a couple of architects sort of in and around town. What do homeowners need to look for in an architect? I dare say it varies on the project type, but what are the key differences? What are the pitfalls to avoid, if you like?
Okay, so when you're picking your architect for your project, bear in mind you're going to be working with your architect for a year to 2 years, depending on the nature of the project. So the first thing is you need to make sure you get on with your architect. You need to trust him to deliver your vision, to actually do what he says he's going to do. So first and foremost, make sure you like the architect, make sure you get on with him, make sure he's on your wavelength. The next thing to do is to look at what the architect does. Does he do a project like the one that you want to undertake? So for example, if he only builds high-rise apartments and you want a cozy extension on the back of your house, perhaps not the best match in terms of an architect. So look at what that architect does. Look at the types of projects he's undertaken in the past. Does the style of how he designs meet your style, your vision of what you want to achieve on your project? And then perhaps ask for references for the architect. A good architect will be willing to provide references of customers and clients they worked with. Speak to those references, check out this architect, and also just check the architect's qualification, that they are registered with the necessary bodies. The architect's registration board would hold details of that architect's qualification. To be called an architect, it's a protected title, and that architect will be registered on the ARB website.
Just talk through the process of getting planning and what it entails, and surveys and costs, and just give people a bit of an idea of what to expect.
Okay, so in terms of the process of design and the project would always start with the client's brief. The brief is a vision of what you want to achieve. It can be a technical document with a setting out a list of criteria of what you want to achieve on your project, or it could be a series of images, a scrapbook almost, of pictures of properties that you like, things you don't like also, because if you want your architect to understand who you are and what you want to achieve, show him the pictures of things you like, things you don't like, and he can quite, or he or she can quite easily pick up on your style and your preferred choice of design.
So then you get the drawings made up, and then when it's time to go to, in this instance, Harrogate Borough Council, what's the process and the timeline involved there?
So the next step of the process really is, once you've got the brief refined and it's a working document with your architect, it's a very important document that sets out where you see the project going. The architect can then start his process of surveying the property, because your architect would need a set of plans to work from in the first instance, to then be able to develop and design ideas with you to then move the project forward through the creative design phase. The creative design phase is the really interesting part of the project. This is where we churn out the ideas, we work with you, we use our expertise and vision for your property to actually push design to the absolute limits. And with you, we will work with you to design and develop the optimum layout for your house. That will then be used to prepare a planning application. And a planning application for a typical domestic project is 8 weeks.
Fine. And then after that 8 weeks, all being well, the council say, yes, happy to approve that, and you can get on with the building works as soon as that's come through.
There are a few more milestones to achieve after
okay,
that.
Okay, it's not
Alex.
As straightforward as that.
Yeah, I wish it was. I wish it was. So the next stages after that are to prepare the more technical drawings that you will need, that a builder would need to build from.
Okay.
So he'll need to understand how is the house built, what type of materials, what type of products, what type of insulation, for example. That is called the building regulations phase. So your architect or technologist will prepare your technical drawings at that stage, and they are submitted to the council or to a building inspector for an approval of those plans. At that point, you can then start to obtain quotes from builders based upon those drawings, and when you're ready to start work, it's about informing building control that you're commencing on site 48 hours in advance.
Crikey. So it's a bit more complicated than I think everyone first thinks, because it's, as I said in the first sentence, it's all well and good thinking you're going to go and get planning for that extension, but there's quite a lot of steps to go through.
Other steps after it to go through, but an architect will be able to guide you through those steps to make your life simpler.
I suppose just flipping it back the other way, we've obviously seen the rise of George Clark on Amazing Spaces, for example, and I suppose the obvious question is, well, look, Nick, it's all well and good talking through all of that. Do I actually need an architect at the end of the day for an extension? Again, I hear on TV it must be so easy. George Clark says, oh, you know what, let's go and build and let's do something, and it's all within this sort of new permitted development rules. Where does George stop and you guys take over?
Okay, so you're in the industry, Alex. You'll know that a well-designed property is going to be worth more, it's going to sell quicker, it's going to get more inquiries.
Yep.
So a well-designed property is worth the investment. So an architect will go above and beyond. Your property will achieve that next level. It will be designed, it will be executed to the highest of standards. The space will be utilized in every direction. It'll be a space you get enjoyment from.
Again, you've got the planning permission, for example, you now want to build it out. Again, it's a split choice decision. Some people say, well, I want my architect to yourself just to sort of, if you like, project manage and sort of oversee it all. And other people sort of say, well, thanks, Nick. Thanks for doing that. And then they sort of ship it out to the builders. What are the pros and cons of doing this? And I guess you guys drew the plans, you know what's going on.
It goes down to your experience. Have you built something before? You know, if we've prepared all the drawings, and a competent set of drawings could be passed to a competent builder to build from without that project management service.
Yeah.
But do you have that link with the builder? Do you have that relationship and trust with the builder that they're going to do a great job for you? Are you able to monitor the quality of the work on the site? Are you comfortable with what you're getting from the builder? And are you comfortable that you're paying them the right amount of money?
Yeah.
So your architect or your architectural practice will be able to guide you through the process in terms of the tender process, in terms of finding you a builder, finding the right builder for that project, and then to manage the payment so you're never paying out more than you should be to the builder, and also checking the quality of the work along the way.
it comes back to exactly what I've always been saying to people. It's experience. You have the experience of knowing what to look for. It's exactly the same on the estate agency side. If you've built up that time and experience within that, and you know now what you're doing, you're fully able to advise clients, because if you know, you know, and if you don't, you're going to be left out in the cold, as they say. I suppose a lot of people, think that architect, not particularly glamorous, you're stuck in the back office sort of thing. How would you counteract that?
Architecture is a wonderful business. We work with such a wide range of people. We get to meet a wide range of people, ranging from people who want to extend or renovate a house up to, we work a lot with charities, and working with charities is great because they need a guiding hand through projects. And through the charity projects we've worked on, we've then got to meet quite a few celebrities and royals at openings.
Nick, let's drop a few names in.
Drop a few names, okay. Princess Anne opened a building for us last June. Which we designed, yeah. We had a really interesting 5 to 10 minute conversation with her on tarmac and what specification of tarmac was used in the car park. AP McCoy was at the opening as well, along with other racing celebrities. And Sophie, Countess of Wessex, also opened a project for us in Cookeridge 3 years ago. So met some wonderful people along the way.
Well, look at you. Well, some fantastic tips and tricks there for architects. And if you want to, I suppose, drop Nick a line and hang out with some of his royal clientele, what is the best way to reach you?
Website is townscape-architects.co.uk. Phone number 01423 505 924.
Nick, fantastic. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Alex.
The Property Hospital, Stray FM.
Every month, I'm here to answer your questions, queries, and quibbles when it comes to the property market. And this month, we've got Beth in, and she's got this for me.
Alex, the estate agent feels putting up a for sale board at my house will help the sale. I'm not so sure, and feel they're just using it for profile. Plus, I'm mindful that the neighbours may now look my house up, as they're not currently aware it's for sale. What's the best thing to do?
Great question there, Beth, and one actually very commonly asked. Now, for sale boards are a very useful tool in the range of marketing options at an agent's disposal. Firstly, you never know who's actually going to be driving or walking past the property, and is, of course, this is free to you because the agent pays for it. And secondly, for viewing purposes, it clearly states where your property is. And the last thing you ever want is a viewer running late due to traffic and they can't find your house. You need to be waving from a distance where you are so they can see it and start to relax before they come through the door. Now, regarding your neighbours, I'd simply say that, look, everyone nowadays is actually connected online, and therefore, in fairness, your neighbours probably already know about the sale, especially if they've got an automated website search set up. So look, overall, I'd certainly say go for it initially. And if you feel it's been up long enough, then just ask the agent to take it down. But at least at that point, you've been able to make an informed decision. And I hope this helps.
The Property Hot Seat. Stray FM. Name.
Ben Thornton.
Business.
Planpix.com.
Time in property.
10 years.
Very exciting indeed to have Ben Thornton here in the studio with me. He really is a very experienced property photographer. Ben, thanks very much for coming in. I suppose one of the main questions that you often come across, and certainly I come across, is why people feel that it's necessary to use a professional photographer when at the end of the day, a lot of estate agents nowadays, they've got the, I say, professional-looking digital camera kit. What's the difference between an agent just doing a point-and-shoot camera versus someone like yourself at Planpix?
Well, I think the most important point is an estate agent has got 101 things on their to-do list.
Yeah.
Whereas a property photographer has one thing, and that's to take images that will sell the house. Firstly, they've got the latest and the best kit, lighting, cameras, lenses, whereas the estate agent possibly won't. Will be just, in most cases, using their iPhone or point-and-shoot camera. The professional photographer will also advise on room layouts, you know, presentation, also revisit when the weather is better, possibly.
You mentioned about sort of presentation of a room, and I know this is a sort of a very much a hot topic. What do you feel are the key points point that you want to, I suppose, convey to people, because often it's something that they get a bit het up about, they're not quite sure what to do. With your experience, what are the key points you need to look for?
The advice I usually give is to declutter everything. That's the first bit of advice I'd give. For example, look at a sitting room. We'd normally pull all the sofas out as far as possible.
Yeah, good point.
To make the ground space look as big as possible. What we're not trying to do is to distort the truth by using fisheye lenses, but by, you know, moving the furniture to the edges of the room will make it feel lighter, brighter area.
Is it true that you want to be taking internal photographs on a bright day or a rainy day, or how do you actually fit that in?
In the ideal world, it would be brilliant if we could have sun throughout the whole year in England, but for the majority of cases, an overcast day for internal photos is an advantage, because with the lighting kit that we use internally, we can control the lighting and create some really fabulous pictures.
I guess it's a case of when you sometimes see that you've just got that big flash of white light against the windows, with what you use, you can actually see straight through into the garden. It's as your eyes would see it.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I mean, it's down to a number of things. It's down to the actual cameras we're using, the techniques we're using, and the lighting. But, you know, getting all of those things right makes the shots that we provide the agent essentially look like what you're seeing, if anything, better.
Yeah, I know, and I think it's, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's a common misconception whereby people almost get confused, because what your very sensitive eyes see versus, let's face it, sadly, a bit of plastic camera kit sees, then it's got to be printed out, I think, are two very, I think, extreme opposites, and it's how you sort of work the room and get the best presentation out of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think it's just getting the balance exactly right. Everything from the colours to the room presentation, the lighting. We put a lot of effort, I would say probably over half of the time is in the editing, which again is over and above what your agent would do with their point and press camera.
It's a real hot topic, because I often see, again, as two extremes. You often see these very heavily edited, evidently it's done through on Photoshop, where you've got the Mediterranean skyline that we've had today, but hold on, the original picture was taken in winter, or it's actually pouring with rain. Where's that fine line for you?
As we talked about the internal pictures, it's not always a beautiful day. So, but with the external pictures and blue skies, for about 80% of the time, we replace and add blue skies, but we do it in a very, very subtle way.
Yeah.
So, to the untrained eye, it's not noticeable.
I know there are alternatives such as masked photography, and just talk everyone through that, because I know it's a term widely thrown around, but what does that actually entail?
Yeah, so we use portable elevated masts, and basically what they do is they give us, the camera is sent up on a telescopic pole around 40, 50 feet. In most cases, we only use elevation probably about 20 or 30 feet max. And what it is basically to straighten the perspective of the property rather than looking up at it. It works just as well for a terraced house as it would do a £5 million country house.
Yeah.
And the advantage of the ones that we've got, they're portable. So rather than driving a van through somebody's garden, we can jump into the neighbouring field or tuck ourselves into a very tight space.
So it's handheld and it goes where you go, rather than, if you like, there are a few of them in and around the area whereby it's actually bolted on physically to a van or a car, you are restricted by where that vehicle can go at the end of the day.
Yes, exactly, yeah. The convenience is brilliant. We can go into, like I say, neighbouring gardens to get the perfect shot.
Where does it stand once you've taken the images and you've given them to the estate agent? Who actually, I say, owns those photographs? Is it done on a licence? Is it copyright? Does the agent own them? Does the actual homeowner own them? Where does the land lie with you?
Well, usually the agreements that we have with the agent is that we own the photographs.
Yep.
The instructing agent can use that photograph for whatever purpose they see fit, whether it be for selling the house, for just general presentation on their website,
yep,
other marketing. If a homeowner instructs us directly, they've got full use of the pictures, and if they swap instructing agents, they can take that those pictures with them also.
So if, for example, the agent instructs you, but it's actually the homeowner that effectively is paying you directly rather than the agent, what happens then? Do the photographs belong to the homeowner or do they belong to the agent?
Well, in that case, where the homeowner is paying us directly, that the homeowner gets the full use of the pictures and can take, you can do whatever they want with them. It's only when the instructing agent pays that it's for their use only.
It all comes back to effectively who's paid you, whether it's the agent, in which case it's over to them, and if it happens to be the homeowner, albeit could be through the agent, then they own it as well.
Yes, that's right.
Got you. Just in summary, what should people who are thinking of coming onto the market, what do they actually need to look for? Because again, it's a fairly competitive sector, property photography. There are quite a few people that do it. What are the key elements that homeowners need to look for in a professional photographer such as yourself?
Well, firstly, I think when looking for a photographer is to find somebody who only takes pictures of properties.
Yeah.
Rather than moonlights as a wedding photographer, as a portrait photographer.
That's a very good point.
You know, someone whose speciality is property photography. And then secondly, looking at the experience, what they've done, because anybody can buy a camera from Jessop's and call themselves a professional photographer, but you need to see examples of what they've done. Whichever agent you ultimately go with, they should be able to provide you with plenty of examples of what they've done, internal, external pictures, elevated shots. Obviously, with using a specialist property photographer, they'll be able to give you the time to discuss property presentation, and if the weather's poor, to revisit.
No, it's really great, Ben. Thanks very much indeed. Just tell everyone, if they want to reach you, just tell them the website and your contact number.
Yes, if you would like to contact me, please go to www.planpix.com, and my number is 07968 445 329.
Ben, that's great. Thanks very much indeed for coming on.
Alex Goldstein's top tip.
When you come to buy or sell a property, please always ensure you use a good quality conveyancing solicitor. People sometimes think this is an easy way to cut a corner and save a bit of money, when actually it's the very thing that will cost them personally down the line. So, one side of things, when you come to sell, a good quality solicitor will prepare everything in advance, remain proactive throughout, and most importantly, will be the single point of contact throughout the process. Going through a mass volume, conveyor belt type solicitor is really not the way to go. And I recently came across a situation, and it was a small chain and involved this very type of solicitor. And what happened was that it took just over 3 months to exchange contracts. By comparison, the other solicitor would have seen it through in under 2 months. That's the difference. When you come to buy, a solicitor needs to check all the legal options on a property. Again, the number of situations I've come across where a mass volume, low experience solicitor was used historically when they bought, but failed to see the right of way at the back, or the worst one actually I've ever seen, is an historic footpath coming right up the driveway to the front door of the property. So the lesson is, pay only a smidge more, but get a good quality solicitor, as you have to personally live with the consequences if they forget about that historic footpath. If you're unsure who to use, just drop me a line. What a show! That's all from Alex Goldstein's Property Show. More details, tips, tricks, and industry insight can be found on the website alexgoldstein.co.uk, and of course, all my social media channels. Alternatively, drop me a line on email. Make sure you look out for my new Saturday Yorkshire Post property column, which is out in the next few weeks. The next episode is out on the 1st of September, when we have Harrogate's answer to Phil Spencer, plus lots more property tips and tricks. Until next time.